You're with SBS Radio.
Whatamooli and welcome to NITV Radio. I'm Kerry Lee Harding. It's that time of the week again where we get to check in and talk all things science and technology with Wiradjuri woman and journalist Ray Johnston. Welcome back to the program, Ray.
Thanks for having me back, Seth.
Lovely to have you back. Now, first cab off the rank today in our science and tech segment, you're going to tell us that the new hottest year on record is likely to occur in the next 5 years, sis.
Yeah, that's right, sis. So there's a 90% chance that at least 1 year between 2021 and 2025 will be the warmest on record. So that would kick the year 2016 out of the top spot. And this is according to the Global Annual to Decadal Climate Update, which is issued by the World Meteorological Organization. And according to the update, there's also about a 40% chance of the annual average global temperature temporarily, this is important to know, it's only temporarily, reaching 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial levels at least one of the next 5 years. So these are more than just statistics. You know, I'm throwing a bunch of numbers at you here, but increasing temperatures, it means more melting ice, higher sea levels, more heat waves and other extreme weather, and greater impacts on food security and health and the environment and sustainable development. It impacts on absolutely everything. So having numbers like this and knowing what's in our future is really important so that we can plan for these events.
Now we're going to talk about wetlands that are actually threatened by complex and convoluted rules from Murray-Darling Basin. What can you tell us about this story, sis?
Yeah, this is an important one. You know, freshwater ecosystems, they're among the most vulnerable and endangered ecosystems in the world. And you know, they're facing continued uncertainty under climate change. We just don't know what's going to happen with them because there's also the development of water resources, and land use change. Just we don't generally treat our wetlands very well, unfortunately. And all the conservation efforts for our significant wetlands, especially in the Murray-Darling Basin, they're being held back by really complex and unclear legislation. And this is according to research out of the Australian National University, who studied the Murray-Darling Basin's plan approach, their approach to managing the ecological character, they call it, of the water system. And all of these rules, they're really complicated, difficult to follow, they contradict each other, and the researchers say that they lead to poor coordination of roles around conservation efforts. It's really hard how to know how to focus conservation efforts. And they said that there's a real lack of a clear plan to meet Australia's international obligations to protect its significant wetlands, because we do have obligations to protect it. The researchers also said that there's a real lack of transparency and accountability. So it looks like we really need to look at the Murray-Darling Basin plan. You know, contact your local Member of Parliament, see what they know about it, and get some change happening in that area so that we can protect these really important freshwater ecosystems.
Now we're talking about environment on our science and technology segment today, sis, and you're going to tell us a story about stormwater and how it's actually feeding microplastics into the ocean, sis.
Yeah, so most city storm drains, they end up straight in wetlands, creeks, rivers, and rainwater running into these drains just becomes this big concoction of whatever's on the ground. So dirt and grass clippings, car fluids, fertilizer, garbage. And recently research has also found that strong rains can put microplastics into the stormwater. But the importance of this runoff as a source of contamination, you know, knowing how bad it actually is, it hasn't really been well understood. So researchers wanted to see whether microplastics and other tiny particles are carried into waterways by storms in urban areas. And they also wanted to look at whether a rain garden could stop that from happening. Now, a rain garden is a literal landscaped garden that's placed in the stream of water. And the researchers collected water during heavy rainstorms from 12 different streams flowing into a bay for this experiment. And then they compared the microparticles entering a rain garden to those at the outflow to the storm drain, so on the other side of the rain garden. And they showed that that rain garden, it captured 91 to 98% of all the microparticles and 100% of all of the black rubbery fragments that they found during three different rain events. So the researchers, they say that while rain gardens are known to reduce the amount of metals and nutrients and other pollutants in stormwater runoff, this study shows that they could also be really effective at stopping microplastic pollution as well. So who would have thought? We'll just put more nature everywhere, Kerry Lee, and then we'll be able to fix the waterways.
Sounds too simple, sis, but I'm sure it's a little bit more complex than that, eh?
It probably will be, yeah.
Now to our next story of the week on our science and technology segment, and you've got a story to tell us about coral reefs, sis. What can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, so table corals, they've been called extraordinary ecosystem engineers. That's kind of their little nickname at the moment, because new research is showing that they can regenerate coral reef habitats on the Great Barrier Reef in particular faster than any other coral type. So this research, it looked at all the different types of corals that are on the reef. And looking at these table corals in particular, it showed that overall reef recovery would be a lot slower if they were in lesser numbers or if they disappeared completely, because they're really fast growing. And habitats, especially in exposed reef slopes, they recover from disturbances at a rate 14 times higher. That's more than two decades faster when there's table corals around. And the researchers say that we can think about table corals as a bit of a mega coral of the Great Barrier Reef, you know, just like whales and turtles and dolphins are like the mega fauna. These are the mega coral. And they're these big, flat, plate-like shaped corals, and they provide a lot of protection for large fish in the shallow reef areas. And they're also a shelter for small fishes. And some species are almost entirely dependent on table corals. And even after they die, these corals provide a lot of value because their skeletons are the preferred place for young corals of all types to settle on and to grow. So they're really, really important to the Great Barrier Reef. And, you know, thinking about table corals and this research into table corals, it's got researchers thinking about how we can look at protecting corals based on how they function within the coral ecosystem rather than based on their risk of extinction, because that's how we normally look at the coral reef. We go, well, this coral's at risk of declining, so we need to do whatever we can do to protect it. Whereas if we look at, well, this coral helps the reef regenerate easier and, you know, provides the most value to the ecosystem, let's look at what we can do to protect that instead. And I think we're going to see a lot of progress if that's a path that we can take.
That's a positive news story there, if ever I've heard one. And thank you for teaching me all about table corals, sis, today.
No worries. I got a bit carried away there. Hope you learnt something.
Absolutely did. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program again right here on NITV Radio. Ray Johnston, Wiradjuri woman and journalist, thanks for joining us for yet another science and technology segment.
Anytime, sis.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.